Welcome to Biblical Foundations, a podcast of the Center for Biblical Studies at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. I'm your co-host, Jimmy Rowe, along with Dr. Andreas Kostenberger. Join us as we discuss issues in biblical scholarship for the church.
It seems like what you've said so far is simply that 37 years means 730 years. And so again, if the start date of 39 is reliable, then it's really impossible to make the 4 BC date of for Herod the Great's death work. Is that right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so Josephus' original description of Herod's life in his first book, The War of the Jews, did not have any consular years mentioned. When he wrote his second book, The Antiquities, he added the consular years for the sake of his Roman audience. But he apparently assigned one of those consular years wrong. Then, since originally his original source that he used when writing the war showed that there were 3 years between Herod's investiture as king in Rome and his capturing of Jerusalem, he assigned a second consular year that was 3 years different from the first one he used. This makes us think the two consular years are independent, but they really aren't. When we build our chronology on the life of Herod from these consular years, we will get multiple conflicts with other statements in Josephus regarding the history of the time. That is the thesis of our forthcoming article in Bibliotheca Sacra. It is also the thesis of our article that will appear in the next issue of the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society that should be hitting the newsstands and out in the mail in the next few weeks. The article deals with the Emperor Caligula's statue that he ordered to be put in the Holy of Holies in the Temple at Jerusalem, and which you, with as editor, are, of course, already familiar. The date of this conflict with the dates of the majority scholarship assigns to the reign of Herod the Great, and the difficulty that these scholars have with the Caligula statue incident is thoroughly examined in this article.
Yeah, Roger, I'm going to ask you in a minute if you would like to add something, but I think maybe for our listeners, it's interesting to notice here that, we simply can't take what Josephus says always at face value. Isn't that part of the issue, that even though generally you may have a presumption that since often he's our only source for a given event or time period that he covers, that generally we might expect him to be accurate, but I think there's demonstrable instances, and you may have uncovered one of them in this regard, that he's not always accurate, and sometimes simply error might creep in, and it's important for us to keep that in mind as biblical scholars, that as invaluable as Josephus is as a source, he's simply not infallible.
I think we should say Josephus, for the most part, is trying to be accurate, but he, like every other human being, and indeed like every historian, is subject to mistakes, and just as we all are.
Right. Roger?
When he consular year for Herod's investiture by the Romans, he also gave the Olympiad year. And even Schurer and other people, they all agree his Olympiad year was wrong. So that makes us suspect right away his consular years. Now, as you said, Dr. Kostenberger, we need to maybe check against other things, and we have a good statement that if we have two witnesses from Paul Meyer, two witnesses to something in ancient history, that pretty well settles it, he thinks. That's Paul Meyer's quote.
Yep.
And yet we had three witnesses, remember, that Ventidius did not go to Syria until after the Treaty of Misenum, which was August of 39 BC. Now, we have Appian, we have Dio Cassius, and we have Plutarch. All are very explicit on that. And Josephus also says that when Herod went to claim his crown, Ventidius was already there. These are actually four witnesses that are saying that the conventional chronology has to be wrong, and that the date of 40 BC, which they try to stretch or to compress really to get to 4 BC, there's something wrong there. And it's unfortunate that most scholars actually omit these very important and independent testimonies that there's something wrong with Josephus's consular dates. Now, I would like to add that one reason that the consensus scholarship tries to use inclusive numbering to try to squeeze that to 4 BC is, and they will not abandon those consular dates, is that it seems to fit the fact that Herod's three sons reckoned their dates, their reigns, to start in either 5 or 4 BC.
Mm-hmm.
We, Andy and I, maintain that this is the case, and other scholars are, we particularly are building on a man called W.E. Filmer. We maintain that this is a case of what is called antedating. That is, they counted the start of their reigns not from when their father Herod died, but from a time before that when they were given some authority over various areas while their father was still alive. One evidence that this is the case is that although there are hundreds and perhaps even thousands of coins from the three sons who succeeded Herod, none of these coins that have a date, that is a year of reign, give the year as 1, 2, or 3. We have calculated the probability that this could come about by chance, and it is extremely small. Our explanation is that the three sons, Archelaus, Herod Philip, and Antipas, could not mint coins during those years, which correspond to 4, 3, and 2 BC, because their father was still alive at that time, and any coins minted would have had his name, not theirs. We're trying to find out how many dated coins there were on the, for these three sons, and it may be in the thousands, and we're preparing a paper on this and trying to maybe find some coin experts that can help us give an estimate. But it's very obvious that something is made that they could not mint coins in their first three years of reign.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fascinating area. And like you said, coin evidence, that's a whole different field of study, of course, is important there as well. I'm glad, Roger, that you addressed that, maybe anticipated that possible rejection, because you're right. You know, if as you argue, I think very plausibly, Herod's death is actually more likely dated in 1 BC rather than in 4 BC. I think some of our listeners who are familiar with those matters would have asked, well, how come then that the reign of Herod's son is conventionally dated to 4 BC? So I think you've certainly given a very plausible explanation for that. You know, I think for myself, you know, I think I've been part of the conventional consensus holding to the 4 BC date for Herod's death in part, you know, just because that seemed to be the consensus, never having really done the kind of detailed historical work that you've done. But I would say you've certainly convinced me, and I think it's important to see that you know, you simply have to go with the evidence. And if you once you're confronted with the evidence, you continue to hold on to some sort of a conventional explanation. At that point, you know, you're no longer, I think, living up to the highest calling of a scholar, which is to be, as you've said multiple times, which is to be guided by the evidence, you know, not by some traditional, you know, construction. So thank you very much. And I know for our listeners, it requires fairly close tracking with your argument, but, you know, this is why this is a specialized field that is rather complex, but clearly very, very important, as it strikes very close to the heart of our Christian faith. In this case, the date of Jesus' birth, which is obviously directly related to the question of Herod's death. Now, another related issue in that regard is the census Luke tells us about that was conducted by Quirinius, which, according to Luke, prompted Jesus' parents to travel to Bethlehem, where Jesus was born. Of course, that's very important because Old Testament prophets such as Micah predicted that the Messiah, the son of David, would be born in Bethlehem. So in this way, Quirinius was used by God to ensure that Jesus was in fact born in Bethlehem and in Judea rather than in Nazareth, in the north, in Galilee, where Jesus' parents lived. I think as some of our listeners probably realize, people have questioned Luke's accuracy here, as we have no extra biblical confirmation of such a census being conducted. So Help us. How are we to resolve this apparent difficulty?
Well, if I might take that up.
Yeah.
A lot has been written about this, and various theories try to explain how this census of Quirinius, that is usually dated to 86, can agree with the census recorded in Luke that took place when Mary and Joseph went to Bethlehem while Quirinius was governing, as Luke said. The theories trying to explain this discuss whether there were two times when Quirinius was governor, or just what the Greek word usually translated as governing means. We should realize that the idea that Quirinius was governor in 86 comes entirely from Josephus, and we have been discussing earlier about how we have to check what he says. Well, there are no other early sources that establish this. So one really simple way to put it, this is to ask, whom do we believe, Josephus or Luke? That might settle it for many, but we need to take into account that scholars generally think that Josephus is accurate, because he gives so many details about what happened in the time of Quirinius, which he dates to 86.
Mm-hmm.
Our explanation takes a different tack. Annie and I think the whole problem is explained by an article that appeared in the March 2011 issue of the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, for which you, Andreas, were and continue to be the chief editor.
Mm-hmm.
That article was entitled, Josephus Misstated the Census of Quirinius. It was by Andy's colleague at the time at Concordia University of Chicago, John Rhodes. In his JETS article, Dr. Rhodes basically followed the lead of some earlier scholars who wrote in German and who are largely neglected in the study of the Quirinius question. John and these earlier scholars say that there are things that happened in Josephus' account of Quirinius that supposedly took place in 86, that are strangely similar to events that Josephus related as happening in the last days of Herod in late 2 and early 1 BC. These are events like the uprising caused by three religious teachers in 2 BC that sound just like events that supposedly happened later in 86. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to distinguish, to disentangle all this, all these events, and the article by John Rhodes is difficult reading. I had to read it 3 times before I thought I really understood it.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult reading. But some things are fairly easy to understand, such as the puzzling similarity of the three rebellious religious teachers in 2 BC with the three rebellious religious teachers in 86.
Uh-huh.
But there's an even easier to understand something in the problem presented by the high priest Joazar. In late 2 BC or early 1 BC, there were those are dates we accept for the closing months of Herod the Great. In that time, Herod removed the reigning high priest from his office and installed in his place this Joazar, because Joazar was more in sympathy with Herod's policies of not giving offense to the Romans. But after Herod's death just a few weeks later, the people demanded that Herod's successor Archelaus remove Joazar from the priesthood, which Archelaus did. So Joazar stopped being high priest just a matter of days or weeks after Herod died and Archelaus took the throne. Yet in the account of Quirinius, as found in Josephus, we have Joazar as high priest, supposedly in 86.
Mm.
How can this be unless the time of Quirinius is moved back to where it should be, that is to late 2 or early 1 BC when Herod died and Joazar was deposed soon after by Archelaus? Although much of what John Rhodes wrote requires a lot of thought, the problem with Joazar is simple enough to understand and it has been puzzling to scholars. Now that includes the chief scholar who writes on the Judean high priest, whose name is James Vanderkam. We think the answer to Vanderkam's puzzlement is explained by Rhodes' articles titled Josephus Misstated the Census of Quirinius, and that Quirinius was really governing Judea when Jesus was born, as Luke said. Maybe Andy has more to say about that because that was his former colleague.
Well, in my discussions with John, it was clear that he had isolated the fact that Josephus was dependent upon sources. Let's keep in mind, Josephus was not alive when Jesus was born. In fact, he was not alive during Jesus' ministry. And so Josephus had these sources, and Rhodes in his article lays out the fact that it appears as if Josephus is using 2 or 3 sources and trying to make sense of all of them. And that he does it in one way in Jewish War and another way in his Antiquities.
Mm.
And that, you know, one is probably a revision of the other. His Antiquities is probably a revision of his stuff in Jewish Wars. And so Rhodes, I think, has done a very careful work at looking at how Josephus as a historian used his sources, and also then indicating for us how any historian, Josephus included, can sometimes misunderstand his sources mm-hmm. and later go back and try to correct himself in a later work. And so I would commend John for mm-hmm. what he has done there, because it's very hard and exacting work, but he's paid very close attention to what's going on in Josephus and his work.
Yeah, well, Professor Simon, I'm very grateful to you that you pointed that out. I think it's so important to realize. I think Josephus's dates are 37 to 100 AD. And so he simply, even though he was close to the time, but he still had to rely on other sources. And so that introduces always that extra level and then possibility of error if he misunderstands his sources. Very fascinating, and again important to realize some of the limitations that Josephus was operating under. Now, while we're talking about significant dates and chronological issues related to Jesus' life, why don't we talk briefly as well about the dates for the beginning of Jesus' ministry and the crucifixion. Again, the older consensus may be described as holding that Jesus started his ministry in around 26 AD and that he was crucified in AD 30. Now, both the two of you and I in several publications have argued that alternative dates are preferable. Again, can you please lay out the rationale both for the older consensus and then show why there's a more likely set of dates, and perhaps even address the question, so what difference does it make?
Yeah, well, the older consensus is largely built upon something we've already discussed. Mm-hmm. The dates come from Emil Schur with his birth of Jesus in 5 and death of Herod, you know, in 4 BC.
Right.
As we said previously, this calculation was based on the consular dates from Josephus, and we believe that those are wrong. Nevertheless, the older consensus still has to explain how Jesus could have been about 30 years old in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. That's from Luke 3:1. Mm-hmm. If he was born before Herod died in 4 BC. Although all extant Roman records and coins would indicate that Tiberius' 15th year was AD 29, some try to place it in AD 26 to make it work with this chronology.
Right.
And this is based on dubious reckoning that since Tiberius was given some ruling privileges under his predecessor Augustus, his reign could be counted from that time. But again, nobody in the first or second century around Tiberius's time did that.
Yes.
And so all those sources that we do have date his reign commencing after the death of Augustus. And so therefore the 15th year is 29. Mm-hmm. So others simply discounted Luke's statement as erroneous. It's just wrong. However, there are multiple problems with placing Jesus' crucifixion in AD 30, including the fact that it doesn't comport well with Roman political climate in AD 30, but fits rather nicely with the Roman political scene of AD 33. Once we recognize that Herod's death should be dated to early 1 BC, then Jesus' birth in early to mid 2 BC would have made him 30 or 31 mm-hmm. in Tiberius' 15th year, 29 AD, making him about 30 years old, just as Luke states. And so once again, we see that Luke is very accurate. He doesn't give us Jesus was exactly 30, but he says about 30. And it's hard to see if Jesus was born in, say, 5 BC, how, say, 34 or 35 years of age is about 30. Mm-hmm. And so, once again, I think it's important to see that the Gospels know the ministry of Jesus and they know when it took place in time. And as the scriptures say, you know, at just the right time, God sent his son mm-hmm. into the world. So it's very, very important that we understand that that's exactly what happened.
That's right. And I remember Harold Honer argued, I think, for a very similar conclusion quite a while back in, I think, a book called Chronological Aspects of a Life of Christ. And so this is not eccentric or novel at all. And most importantly, it's based on the best and most reliable evidence we have. And you know, that's certainly what convinced me that there's simply no early evidence for the supposed co-regency between Tiberius and Augustus at all, while there's ample evidence that Tiberius's reign began after Augustus died, and that would get you to 29 AD. And we know from the Gospels that Jesus' ministry lasted about 3.5 years, and so 33 seems to be much preferable to the older consensus once again, which dated the crucifixion to 30 AD. So again, the evidence, certainly for anyone who claims to be a scholar who's guided by the evidence, ought to carry the day. Now, as we wrap up our podcast, are there any other major chronological issues, maybe related to the New Testament, that our listeners should be aware of that either of you would like to mention, and how would you adjudicate those?
Well, there are a number of important issues relating to the ministry of the Apostle Paul, specifically about when and how many times he visited Jerusalem between his conversion and his trip to Rome to stand trial before the emperor. While there are several competing theories, once it is understood that Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection took place in AD 33, then only one theory really works, and that's that Paul's visit mentioned in Galatians 2:1-10, 14 years after his conversion took place, was at the same time as the Jerusalem Council mentioned in Acts 15. Mm-hmm. This allows us to use all the other chronological markers of Paul's ministry mentioned in his letters and in Acts before his trip to Rome to reconstruct a timeline of his movements and actions from his conversion to his arrest and trial.
Mm-hmm. Roger?
Well, I recently viewed, just a few days ago actually, a video of a lecture that Gary Habermas gave in Santa Barbara in 2012. Now, Gary makes the point that in the previous scholars toward that they've shown toward the gospel narrative.
Hey, Roger, why don't you start again with Gary, because you are breaking up a little, just to make sure that, you know, that's clear.
Shall I start the whole paragraph?
Sure, why not?
Okay. I recently reviewed a video of a lecture that Gary Habermas gave at the University of California, Santa Barbara in 2012. Gary made the point in the lecture that in the previous 30 years, there has been a turnaround in the attitude that New Testament scholars of the skeptical sort had shown toward the gospel narratives of the crucifixion and resurrection. Even Bart Ehrman now says that the earliest formulation of these Christian doctrines goes back to within 1 year of the crucifixion. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 1 to 11 is central to the current thinking and writing on this subject. New Testament scholars of all stripes now agree that Paul is referring in 1 Corinthians 15 to what he learned from Peter, James, and John when he met with them in Jerusalem, comparing what they had said, what they said, and when they saw the risen Jesus with Paul's own Damascus Road experience. Paul said he found no difference. That's in 1 Corinthians 15. He found no difference in their teachings about the risen Christ who met with them and with him after the resurrection. Critics now agree with what conservative scholars have always held, that the writings of Paul show that the basic Christian teaching of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ and the divinity of Christ were taught from the very beginning, that is, from immediately after the resurrection. Even New Testament scholars who might be classified as skeptics because of their prejudice against the supernatural now accept 6 of Paul's epistles as genuine, including Romans and 1 Corinthians. So this is an area where the timing of events, that is, their chronology, is of considerable importance. And it's an area where you, as a New Testament scholar, Dr. Kirstenberger, have, of course, been very concerned in your own writing. Do you have any comments about this development?
Yes. You know, it makes me think of Larry Hurtado, an eminent scholar who recently passed away and who basically devoted his life work to the demonstration that Jesus was worshipped as divine from the very beginning. And of course, he mentored many other fine contemporary scholars, such as my good friend Mike Kruger. You know, another thing that comes to mind is the recent debate between Bart Ehrman, you mentioned him, and my good friend Pete Williams, the principal of Tyndall House, who wrote a very fine book recently, Can We Trust the Gospels? And very interesting, but Bart Ehrman has always said that there's many contradictions between, you know, the different gospels and in various parts of Scripture. But in that debate, he seemed to change his tune because I think he had to recognize the fact that P. Williams showed that the evangelists were very much concerned with every little detail, whether it's geographical or topographical or chronological, cultural, historical, and so forth. And so apparently Ehrman at that debate said, well, maybe they agree on the details, but that doesn't mean that they got the big picture right. And so which is it, right? Are there contradictions in the details or do the details converge? And so seems like Ehrman has been moving the goalpost there lately. And in many ways, I think it gets us back to the evidence. And what you mentioned at the beginning, that we give the biblical writings the benefit of a doubt, and we engage in this empathetic kind of reading that is not immediately jumping to the premature conclusion that any apparent contradiction necessarily is an actual contradiction. Well, Dr. Steinman, Roger Young, thank you so much for engaging in this very helpful, detailed conversation about some of the most important areas in the study of biblical chronology. May God continue to bless you in your work, and thanks again for joining us. I'm sure listeners will greatly appreciate your insights.
Well, thank you, Andreas.
Thank you.
Blessings to you and your hearers also.
Thank you for joining us today at Biblical Foundations. For more information, please visit the Center for Biblical Studies at Midwestern at cbs.mbts.edu. For further resources, please also visit biblicalfoundations.org. Please join us again next time at the Biblical Foundations podcast.